This is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined on the phone by David Goldblatt. David Goldblatt has written perhaps the exceptional history of global soccer. It is called The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer. That, of course, is the American title. It weighs in at 990 pages, and it truly is an amazing work that documents the beginnings of the sport, in fact, going back before the sport is formally soccer, its evolution into soccer, and then the way that it spread around the world, looking at all the different areas of the world and how soccer has emerged there in all of its nuance, with a lot of political, social, and cultural background absolutely integrated into the way that the history of soccer is developed in this fantastic book, The Ball is Round. We'll talk to David Goldblatt in a second about the book and maybe how he sees the 2010 World Cup fitting into the long history of soccer. But first, I want to talk to David Goldblatt about the blogs he was posting from South Africa for Prospect Magazine, which you can find at prospectmagazine.co.uk. And what I want to ask David Goldblatt about initially is that from reading his blogs in particular and a few others that I've read, it seems that there really are two World Cups. One that the vast majority of people around the world experience via their television sets, or perhaps now their internet connections, and the people who are at the games themselves. David Goldblatt now has returned from South Africa to England, so maybe he can do a comparison. How different is it to be at the games and then to experience it on the television? And what does that say about where global football is today? David Goldblatt, welcome to the People's Game.
Yeah, nice. Thank you very much. Quite an introduction. Much appreciated. I mean, I think the first thing one notices when comparing, you know, the World Cup on the sofa from the World Cup being there is the vuvuzela. I mean, certainly in Britain, there's been a great deal of complaint about the vuvuzelas. People want vuvuzela-free coverage. You've had broadcasters having the temerity to ask the organising committee whether they can stop people blowing them. Of course, this has all ended and the vuvuzela is here to stay. But certainly on the television, it does sound like a kind of buzzing group of insects, pretty high-pitched, pretty relentless, not much kind of change in tone or feel. But actually in the stadiums, it's completely different, particularly when you've got a lot of South Africans there who know what they're doing. You know, you get enormous range of volume up and down. You don't just get the high notes. You get all the kind of deep notes. And, in some ways, I think in South Africa, the vuvuzela is love because it's like blowing a raspberry and sticking it to the man. And that's kind of, that's what's in part is going on. It's a great big collective sticking it to the man. You also get, you know, call and response amongst the vuvuzelas in the stadium. So, you know, you'll have one person who's got a little bit more breath, say, than the others, who can toot out a rhythm or a tune, and then people coming in on the final note or the final beat of that. You know, when corners and free kicks happen, again, you get a kind of great swelling of noise at many different levels that really kind of enhances the moment. And I must say, amongst the Ghanaians in particular, who I was lucky enough to sit by, you get some real musical action where the vuvuzelas and the drums are coming together. Now, I'm not saying it's right for every football culture, but certainly in South Africa, often it worked fantastically. So that's part of the immediacy, I think, and difference. I think another thing is that in a funny way, it feels like a much more sort of managed and commercial operation on the television. All the kind of kinks are sort of smoothed out. All the rough edges have been dealt with. And, you know, the advertising and the logos and the branding are all somehow much more up front. Whereas I was finding in South Africa there was so much else to look at and so much else to think about that, in a way, I didn't see Sony and those guys. They just sort of disappeared off into the background, which is another great thing about the vuvuzela, let me tell you, is that it means you can't hear those Coke adverts in the stadium, which is a blessing in itself.
You know, the spectacle here on television is, it is after a while, you're 2 weeks into the tournament, and it all sort of blurs together, at least with ESPN's coverage and also with Univision. You know what to expect every single day. I imagine the dimension of the experience when you're in South Africa, and in particular the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, as opposed to maybe in 2006 in Germany, was just rife with dimension.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, just getting, you know, every day in South Africa, is a sort of practical and moral challenge, you know, in terms of how you're operating and where you're going and what you're doing. So a great deal of, you know, energy is absorbed in a most engaging way just getting about. I mean, South Africa's a pretty big place compared to, say, Germany 2006. And, I mean, I was lucky enough to do some pretty epic journeys as part of it. I went to see the England-Germany game in Bloemfontein, and I drove a round trip of around 2,300 kilometers from Cape Town, which was extraordinary. I mean, obviously what lay at the end in Bloemfontein was not quite as I imagined it, but to drive the Karoo Desert, to see, you know, night desert skies with more stars than I've ever seen, and with the prospect of a round of 16 World Cup at the end of your journey is extraordinary. So at that level, just the kind of the landscapes, the spaces, you know, South Africa is an extraordinary eye-popping country. And then, of course, you know, wherever you look in South Africa, I mean, it makes me laugh that you know, there is talk of countries and cities cleaning themselves up before the world comes and, you know, sweeping stuff under the carpet. I mean, in South Africa, you can't sweep the nature of the society under the carpet. It's there, you know, bare right in front of you, you know, on the run in from Cape Town Airport, you know, towards Greenpoint Stadium, taking a taxi to get myself there on time. You know, you go past South Africans, particularly white South Africans, would say world-class shopping malls and the most unbelievable sort of seafront properties. And then, you know, shanty towns bang next to them, but for a wall and barbed wire pressed up against the motorway. Those sort of contrasts are everywhere in South Africa. I mean, the strongest sort of moment for me, tugging at all of those sorts of emotions and differences, was going to Soccer City in Soweto to see Brazil versus Cote d'Ivoire. And I went there at night, and the stadium is absolutely stunning. I mean, it is designed to be breathtaking. And I don't know how much the television can capture the scale of it, because Soweto, because actually there remains pitifully little street lighting in what is, you know, a city of 2 to 3 million people. Soccer City sits against a kind of, you know, blank, a canvas of almost complete darkness, and you know, is illuminated brilliantly from below, and you approach it over a kind of gigantic bridge, which gives you a sort of sense of almost being in the air. It's a little bit, I don't know, kind of sci-fi almost, the way you approach the sort of spaceship floating in the air. And of course the bridge, again, is swathed in darkness, and below it are some pretty gritty and some pretty run-down railway tracks, which, you know, in the day would make the scene look very different. And it is, you know, there's quite a cynic in me often, but it was swept away by the kind of majesty of this building. And inside the shell, the calabash shell, the hallways make one feel, you know, like a character in, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk in the giant's kind of castle. The scale of it is really awesome. And part of me thinks, you know, that is amazing that that is in Soweto, that something of this scale and grandeur is placed in Soweto and, you know, makes, you know, contributes to making it what it is. And then on the other hand, you see, you know, I also went to Soweto in the daytime to the fan parks and to a Shebeen to watch a game and so on. And, you know, although Soweto's changed massively in the 15 years since I first saw it, you know, the scale of the inequalities and of the sheer urban needs of modern South Africa whack you right in the face. And there we are, you know. I mean, and I don't know what the answer to the question is, you know. Is it the right way to spend a billion bucks? You know, they sure got a bang for it. And South Africa's all about that. It's about almost about sort of unanswerable questions and impossible divisions to straddle that somehow people are grappling and groping towards. And I felt that sort of energy and those issues around every element of the World Cup, and it made it a kind of, you know, an amazing experience to be there.
David Goldblatt has been blogging on the World Cup for Prospect Magazine, and you can find the blogs at prospectmagazine.co.uk. He is also the author of the epic history of soccer entitled The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer. that was originally published in advance of the 2006 World Cup in Germany. The final chapter, the final part of this epic 990-page book, is called The Only Game, Football and the End of History, 1990 to 2006. And then it has a short conclusion entitled The Game at the End of the World. The book, The Ball is Round, does an exceptional job of tracking the evolution of soccer in the political, social, economic, and cultural context of the regions that are being analyzed in each section of the book. Well, since 2006, there have been some significant changes in sort of global geopolitics and economics, in particular, the global financial meltdown of 2007-2008. And it's in the wake of this that this most spectacular of World Cups in South Africa is taking place, though that particular social economic fact seems overwhelmed by the mere fact of this spectacle taking place in Africa itself. So I want to first go back to part five of your book and the conclusion, Football and the End of History, The Game at the End of the World. Following the end of the Cold War, it does seem that global football really further established itself as the global game, the only global game of real significance. Why do you think that that took place in the wake of the Cold War?
Well, I think the wake of the Cold War is also the moment that, you know, the economies of and the technologies of globalization are transformed. You know, as the Berlin Wall is falling, you know, satellites for pay-per-view television are heading into space at a rate of knots. And I think the arrival of satellite television, the arrival of the internet, is absolutely central to the growing popularity of the game. I think it's also the moment, for reasons in part connected to the end of the war, but with their own dynamic, where the commercialization of football in Europe, first and foremost, really begins to take off. And what is created as part of that is an extraordinary televisual spectacular, which is then available all over the world. So I think at that level, that globalization of the highest levels of professional football, which is around which at least some of the kind of global mania for football is created, happens then. I mean, I think the other, you know, the last 20 years have seen, you know, enormous spread, of course, of television and through mobile phones and access to information. So, you know, parts of the world that were just not on the map as far as, you know, engaging with global football or the World Cup, those things have opened up. I'm not sure that football is kind of spread any further just in terms of people playing it or being introduced to it. Football, in a sense, is already, as a participative thing, had already spread. What's changed is how those participative cultures, you know, have been energized or shaped or changed by access to the kind of global professional game.
Let's talk a little bit about the game at the end of the world. What are your primary points that you draw in your conclusion from your book as you wrote it in 2006?
Well, the first thing in the conclusion to the book is just to say why. Why is football at this moment, you know, not merely the global game, but one of, you know, really very few truly popular global cultural phenomena? In an era of globalization in many, many different dimensions, you know, what is there to top it? So that was the question I wanted to ask myself and draw together the threads of the earlier parts of the book. And I concluded, I suppose, you know, there were three elements to the answer that make up that conclusion. One is to say it's something about the game itself. It's something about the political and economic conditions under which it was generated and diffused around the world. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, it's something about the way in which football, I think, in quite a sort of deep and subtle way, speaks to a whole lot of global dilemmas and issues that engage us. So in terms of the game itself, you know, it's about simplicity, it's about flexibility, it's about the fact, you know, you can play it with two, you can play it with three, you can play it with 50. You don't even need to know the rules that well to get a game that basically works. I mean, it's endlessly variable. It can be played on such a variety of surfaces. I think in terms of the dynamics of the game, I think the question of flow is absolutely central. It's that, for me, the sort of unbrokenness of it. And that's not to say that there aren't, of course, you know, great pleasures and narrative structures that emerge from very sequential games like cricket and baseball, which have their own sort of, you know, narrative beauties. But if you, what you want is the sort of rip-roaring, page-turning thriller, then football's kind of inner structure of play seems to deliver that. And, you know, with so few goals, there is a kind of orgasmic punctuation about scoring in football and reflected in its crowds that I don't find in any other sport. You know, I mean, much as I like basketball, it's just, you know, 199-117. It's just not quite the same as 1-0.
But it's Eros and Thanatos, because for one side it's Eros, the other side is Thanatos. I mean, the American audience is just finally catching on that the violation that comes with being scored upon is unto death.
And that's, you know, that's and it's sort of, it's often unjust and irrational, and I kind of like, I like that if you're in the business of storytelling rather than sort of rational theories of justice, football delivers on that. And then, of course, you know, it matters that it's from England and from Britain at the point at which Britain is the global hegemon, at which, you know, Britain's connections with the rest of the world are more extensive than anybody else's, and in which, you know, there's a lot of Anglophilia in the world. You know, I mean, we forget, I think, in Britain that, you know, once upon a time, you know, to be British or to be an Anglophile was to be sophisticated, to be modern, to be liberal, to be advanced. And, you know, football becomes the kind of bearer of that. I mean, of course, it then takes on a thousand other meanings in a thousand other places. And I think that, again, is something interesting with football. I've often wondered whether, you know, the failure of baseball and American football to spread as widely as football is at least in part to do with, you know, their Americanness is buried so deep in the language and the structures of the game that it has been harder for others to make them their own, whereas football has come as a slightly blanker slate. And then
it could also be a reflection of the fact of British colonialism was a straight-on rule, whereas American rule was done by proxy in general.
I think that's true, though, of course, the strange thing with the British Empire is that, you know, in many of places, I mean, where there is direct, you know, direct rule in a sort of major British population, ethnically, you know, they don't play football as their first game initially. So the Australians are off playing Aussie rules football, both codes of rugby, and frankly, anything other than football. In India, you know, the Indian elites opt for cricket as both, you know, an expression of their relationship to England and as a challenge to it, but not to football. The Afrikaners and, you know, English-speaking whites in South Africa choose rugby too. So, and of course, then there's the whole Irish dimension. So I think that's part of the story. And then there was a third thing that I wanted to say about football, which was, I suppose, it has at its heart, it embraces uncertainty. It embraces implausibility in a way that I think, you know, no other game for me quite touches. I mean, I love it that in football it is still possible for, just on occasion, the manifestly weaker team, sometimes the team that plays worst, to win a game, to turn the tables for whatever, you know, extraordinary reason. And that's the sort of world we live in. I think we live in a world of uncertainty and in which reactivity and spontaneity, you know, are what's required. My God, the world is changes before our eyes at a rate that has never happened before in human history. So football for me sort of speaks to that world in a way that nothing else quite manages. And, you know, the World Cup this time around, for me anyway, has been delivering on uncertainty and reactivity and injustice, if not always the most graceful football I've ever seen.
And I think it can play both ways, sometimes both as injustice and sometimes as wish fulfillment, because sometimes, you know, oftentimes the general flow of social, cultural, economic, political history is overwhelmingly imbalanced towards the overdog. And it gives a wish that the underdog can somehow snap back and get that goal against the run of play.
So, yeah,
I see that. That's a very beautiful point. I do want to point out to people, because of course we only have a limited amount of time, that the details of the histories that are told in this book are just unbelievable. So next time you're reflecting on Argentinian soccer, Diego Maradona, Leo Messi, pick up this book and read the section on the development of the sport in Argentina or any other theater as it world. In terms of global football, interested in East Asia, interested in how it developed on the peripheries of the sport and right at the core of the sport. It's so much of it is covered here. It's covered elegantly. And by the way, the individual games that you focus on are recounted with great drama and capturing really the feel of matches. And I can testify to that because later on in the book, of course, I'm familiar with a few of the matches that you recount. Now, I suppose the big question for someone who's written such a book is to try, and I know this is always a difficult question for a historian, to try then to contextualize the 2010 World Cup in the long history of soccer. And I suppose there's sort of three framings that I'll ask about. One is, of course, the fact that it has taken place in Africa, in South Africa, as it relates to the role of Africa in global football. Two, even more general, the where this fits in then into the world in 2010. And then third, more basic, how the games have played out on the field. And in particular, right now, I'm interested in your reflections on the German side and the fact that they've produced this exciting young team out of a Bundesliga that's not as top-loaded with global stars on the top teams like Serie A, La Liga, and the Premiership. So first to the tournament in Africa in the context of the history of the sport.
The tournament in Africa, what I would say is I think this is part of something, a sort of bigger drift, is that, you know, the global sporting mega events of the world are going to the global south. You know, it's 2010 South Africa, it's 2014 Brazil, and I you know, if the rumors that I hear around the FIFA HQ in South Africa are right, 2018 could well be going to Russia. Meantime, they're doing the Winter Olympics in 2014, there's the Rio Olympics, and even India is getting in on the act with the Commonwealth Games later this year. So, I mean, there's indices of, you know, it's not a perfect measure or index of the shifts of power in the new global economy. But it's not a bad one. And I think we should see, in a way, South Africa 2010 as part, and, you know, of course, Beijing 2008 Olympics. Mm-hmm. So I would see it in part as part of that bigger shift of power to the global south that we are seeing. In terms of Africa, I think the thing that's been missing from this World Cup, but I think one has to grasp to understand why it's so important in Africa, beyond merely that, you know, one is having an event and one is taking one's place at the sort of global table, is the depth in popular culture and folk memory of the political and social significance of football. Football, you know, was intimately linked to the liberation struggles in Africa from the beginning of the 20th century right through to independence and post-independence politics. Many African nationalists got their early administrative training in football clubs as an institution that, you know, they were able to run when other avenues were blocked off. And, of course, you know, taking the colonist game and then turning it against them, I mean, that is an extraordinary, you know, it's a display of resistance. It is a way of shaking off the psychological and emotional shackles and injustices of racism and colonialism. I mean, and football is the place that African men and, you know, now in a new generation, African women are taking that stuff. So I think, and that's been missing from this World Cup. I don't think South Africa, I don't think FIFA have really let us in on that one in the way that they have cast the tournament. But that is why it is, you know, people give such a damn, or one of the many reasons people give such a damn about it. I mean, I think in the end it's been, you know, thank the Lord for Ghana, because it was in danger of not being much of an African World Cup. Right. I mean, all the plans to make it African in terms of other Southern African countries hosting, you know, training games or teams in the run-up to the tournament, in terms of the number of Africans who can actually afford to show up or buy a ticket, in terms of almost the African feel of some of South Africa's cities, where, you know, FIFA's kind of super-duper exclusion policy has meant that, you know, local signage and traders have been cleared many, many kilometers away from where the action is, was in danger of, you know, actually making it pretty un-African. And I think Ghana and the way that South Africans of all stripes have got behind Ghana as their team in this tournament has been, you know, has been the saving grace of that and kept it as a kind of, you know, at some level properly as an African World Cup. I mean, I feel for Ghana, you know, they haven't had the best tournament, one of the best stories, and that's a pretty precious thing to take away. Germany, well, what can I tell you? I find myself as an Englishman saying a surprising thing, but I like this German team. Mm-hmm. I mean, I almost felt watching Germany-England like, oh, thank you very much, someone is at last playing football in front of me. and it was pretty painful, I can tell you. But I like them. I like they're kind of open and honest and attacking, and there's movement and action. And like you say, no big stars. They look like a team, and football's a team game, and we're, you know, we're always going on about the stars and we love them, but in essence it's a team game, and it's great to see them play that way.
You know, I'm very hard-pressed to root for them because I traditionally am an Azzurri fan.
Okay.
I grew up partly in Italy, and you know, if you're either a Brazilian, Italian, or German fan, you know, there's this lifelong competition with 5 cups, 4 cups, and 3 cups.
Sure.
So you don't want to see Germany get their fourth, but I am particularly happy to see this team prosper given two things. One is the ownership structure in the Bundesliga, which, of course, Liverpool fans and Manchester United fans only dream of now. And then the fact that, you know, this is a bit of a more player-friendly league again, where Alex Ferguson, even in relationship to Wayne Rooney's bad performance for England, has said, well, you know, they get a winter break over there. And it's reflective of the maintenance of a progressive social democracy in Germany that is not the case in post-Thatcher Britain and elsewhere around the world.
Absolutely. I think, you know, in Germany, let me put it this way. I think that, you know, to do well in a World Cup, more than anything else, you've got to show up as a team. You know, because that's the trick, because, you know, all these guys playing, you know, for their clubs and immersed in another world, and we know it's only a tiny amount of time to get it together to play what is, in essence, a team game. So if you can do that, I mean, my God, Greece proved in 2004, if you can do that and you've got a plan, you can go anywhere. You know, doesn't matter about the kind of individual talent. And, I think the Germans are very, very good at doing that, and I think they bring with them to the national side something of a wider culture in which the public realm and the common good is still accorded a kind of value, importance and respect that certainly in the England that I live in, I find rarer and rarer.
I suppose just two more questions. The second one, and we'll hold this till the end, is we're speaking now a few minutes away from the kickoff of the first semifinal between Uruguay and Holland, and I'll, of course, want to ask you about the final four teams. But before that, I want to go back into the second question. In your book, again, in the final chapter, as I mentioned, you final section, you call it, the only game football in the end of history. The end of history is, of course, a reference to Fukuyama's notion that with the end of the Cold War, history was over. Tina, there is no alternative. Capitalism had won. Liberal democratic capitalism had won. 2007 and 2008, that question was sort of reframed again and reasked because all of a sudden the economic model was in severe global crisis. You're a historian and have really written, in my opinion, the definitive history of soccer that's been written to date. It's an exceptional work. It is, as you say at the beginning, there's no cultural practice more global than soccer. The economy and the political system of the world is more globalized than ever. It's 2010, the summer of 2010. We're still in the throes of this incredible financial crisis at the core of the global economy, and the world is mesmerized by a soccer tournament to a greater degree than I think it has ever been. I think this is the most popular World Cup ever, and as such, probably the most popular single cultural event in human history ever. I know it's early, you're a historian, to reflect on this, but any thoughts about what maybe that all means right now in terms of the, not so much the history of soccer, but the social, historical, cultural, political moment that we all live in as citizens of the globe?
Well, I think a lot of the time we have, you know, generally we have a lot of difficulty really imagining ourselves as citizens of the globe. I mean, it seems, you know, we live in an era in which politically, in terms of security arrangements and military power, as well as economics, you know, we live within global global structures. But our capacity to, you know, imagine ourselves, you know, the imagined community of the people of this planet is much harder to do. There is, you know, it's a harder task anyway. And then to even begin to think about mobilizing, you know, progressive political forces and transformations on the basis of it is an even tougher thing further on. And therefore, I think, you know, in a very political but with a very small p, the World Cup is, you know, gives me a little heart that there are these moments where we, you know, find a way of looking at ourselves, basically looking at ourselves and having a moment where, you know, we step outside of actually our national identities or our limited and local perspectives and engage at a global level, in a properly popular level. Because, you know, I mean, there's, you know, there's elites all over the world who are kind of thinking about these things. That's pen a penny. But to sort of mobilize half the planet, if only at a kind of, you know, cognitive level rather than a sort of analytical level, I think is a really special and amazing thing. So it's a small thing, but it's a moment. I mean, in terms of the sort of wider financial crisis and the state of global capitalism, and I think, you know, football, like every other institution on the planet, has got some choices to make. Do you want to keep running the game, certainly at the professional level, along lines and models of, you know, the neoliberal consensus, which is certainly what we've done in England over the last 20 years, or are we going to think about alternative systems of regulation and alternative systems of ownership? We know certainly in football there is an alternative, and I'm not sure, you know, well, we'll see how the narratives play out, but you know, at the moment, it may be that a German victory just might nudge a few people to think a bit more in that direction.
That's a fine point indeed. Almost will make me feel okay if now perhaps the tournament favorite does collect that fourth star on their jersey, tying my former loves, the Azzurri, who were so wretched this time I couldn't get even barely behind them. So the final four teams, David Goldblatt, I'm speaking with the author of The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer. We do have this marvelous semifinal tomorrow, Spain versus Germany. This will not have taken place when this interview airs. Do you think that the Spanish, who defeated Germany only in 2008 in the Euro final, rather authoritatively, do you think that that team, which is much the same as it was in 2008, has enough to withstand this new German dynamism?
Oh, I think it does. I think they have to drop Torres. I mean, if they don't drop Torres, then they're playing 10 against 11, and I don't recommend that against this Germany. He's clearly not fit. He's not going to ease himself back into match fitness in a World Cup semi-final. It's time to bite the bullet and drop the boy and put somebody else on. And, you know, when Fabregas was on, I thought Spain looked a different team. If they do that and they raise their game to where it can be, and maybe Germany will do enough attacking to give them the space to get their own passing game going, then they can. But I think this is completely even, and this is not the Germany they faced in 2008, and I expect it to be much, much tougher for them. So they can do it, but not with the team that's been playing now. There has to be change.
Holland and Uruguay will have taken place by the time this interview airs. I'll walk out on that gangplank and say that as much as Uruguay have been canny, they have structured their game very well for every opponent. With the people who are absent today, I will be very shocked if they can really stay in this game and give Holland a run for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, they've lost two of their key players. Suarez and what's the other guy called?
Well, Lugano may play.
Lugano as well.
And Fusile is out, right? Yeah.
So
I expect Lugano to take the field at some point, just because he's such a gamer. But we'll see in a few minutes.
We'll see, but then, you know, he may not be much help if he's not properly fit. I mean, with Uruguay, you know, on the one hand, I'm cross about Ghana, but I'm not that cross. I mean, it's hard. as a historian of football and as a lover of the little guy,
right.
It's really hard not to love Uruguay. And having spent an absolutely fantastic, tranquil, beautiful week in Montevideo exploring all of this, I have got such a soft spot for Uruguay. It's not true. So I'm going into this game on pure and utterly irrational emotion and nostalgia. And I'm going to be rooting for Uruguay, but I'll be planning for Holland.
Well, David Goldblatt, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. David Goldblatt is the author of the epic History of Soccer, The Ball is Around, A Global History of Soccer. Pick it up. It is just infinitely delightful to read and informative. And then you can also read his blog postings for Prospect Magazine at prospectmagazine.co.uk. David Goldblatt, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.